Nice. Welcome to Red Eyes Creations live broadcast. It is March the 30th. I hope you are settled in and ready for an interesting program. Nice to have you here. If you're tuning in either live or through our archives in the future, good to have you with us. My name is Henrik Palmgren. I'm the host of Red Eyes Creations Radio, and we are coming to you live from our studio on the west coast of Sweden. And wherever you are around the world, you can find us online at redeyescreations.com. Today we have Christopher Knowles back with us on the program, and we are mainly going to focus on movie symbolism today and talk about everything from Solaris, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, to The Wicker Man, the older version, The X-Files, The 40-Year-Old Virgin, and we're also going to go into a few other interesting avenues of esoteric subjects, like the Academy Awards, the Oscar ceremony. So we have a lot to discuss here today. Christopher Knowles is the author of Our Gods Wear Spandex, and we had Chris with us for the first time on a radio show back in November last year. And we're glad to have him back with us today for our premiere of our first live program. So let's say hi to our guest. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Henrik. It's great to be here.
We're very glad to have you. Thank you for coming on. As we have mentioned on our website and our live promo, we have about 4 copies here of Chris' book, Our Gods Wear Spandex, that we're going to give away, or quiz away rather, today, I guess, during the program. 2 in our first segment, and 2, the remaining 2, in our second segment for Red Eyes Creations members. And there's 2 ways you can contact us. First, via email, redeyescreations@gmail.com. Or you can call us via Skype. Just search or add a new contact. Our name there is Red Eyes Live. And you'll get to talk to Fredrik out in the control room, and we'll let you on at the end of this segment here if you got the correct answer. So the first one who contact us either via email or through Skype with the correct answer is going to win a copy of Chris Knowles' latest book here. So why don't we begin, Chris, with that, and you can actually pop out that first question that we have so people can have a chance to have a little time to ponder on that for a while, okay?
Very good. This is the first trivia question to win the free copy of Our Gods Wear Spandex, and it goes like this. Before he had his first comic in the 1960s, Jack Kirby created Thor as a villain. Which superhero did this version of Thor fight?
Take it one more time, Chris.
All right. Before he had his own comic in the 1960s, Jack Kirby created Thor as a villain. Which superhero did this version of Thor fight?
All right, there we go. So when you think you have the right answer, call us in via Skype, or alternatively contact us via email, redeyescreations@gmail.com. Again, the Skype name is Red Eyes Live. Okay, so we'll ponder upon that and contact us. What we're going to do now is dive into the interesting world of movie symbolism, and we're going to talk about Solaris, the Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, and a few others that I mentioned. But first, I want to ask you a little bit, Chris, about the new and upcoming, I guess, book that you have on movie symbolism. Why don't you begin? Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. This is a book that I wrote 2 years ago. I pitched it along with Our Gods Wear Spandex to agents and publishers. Everyone seemed to agree that I should go with Our Gods Wear Spandex because it's easier to digest, it's shorter, and all these kind of things. This book is written. I'm going to be doing some revising on it. On my blog, The Secret Sun, I am actually incorporating new ideas. I'm using the blog as a way to develop ideas that I've been coming across or that I've realized, and that a lot of that material will be added to the book. The book is actually very long right now. It might be unpublishable in this market. I don't need to tell everybody that the U.S. economy is not doing well. There's a major bookseller named Borders, which is sort of teetering on the edge of bankruptcy. It's a very tough market right now, and there's also a very there's a cultural problem with publishers that they really tend to avoid material that's challenging. They tend to avoid material that is too long, too weighty. It's very difficult right now. You know, if worse comes to worse, I will self-publish the book. I do have some interest in it, and I do have an obligation for another book or first refusal to Wiser. And I'm also got another book in the works that's very much in the planning stages right now, which would be on rock and roll and some of the ancient influences on rock and roll music that a lot of people might be familiar with. So that might actually be my next book. And this book is very much still a work in progress, even though I've got a first manuscript completed.
Hmm. And wouldn't you say that it's better to actually self-publish the book, though? You have more control over the material?
Well, my attitude is this. This book was very much a process of discovery for me. It was an amazing experience. It was very much sort of a breadcrumb trail that I followed back and back and back in time. There's an enormous amount of notes. I have 25 pages of footnotes. I have all sorts of excerpts and things like that from older material. I generally concentrated, believe it or not, for a movie, a book about movies, I concentrated on material from the 19th century, which there was a lot of excellent books being published on the mysteries, on Gnosticism, on ancient Egypt. You know, we had people like Wallace Budge putting out a lot of material there. And, you know, I want the book to remain intact. I do not want the book to be censored or edited in any way.
Right.
And that's a very difficult thing in today's book market. But I owe it to myself, I owe it to the material, and I owe it to the people who really want to read this material. Spandex was actually originally a much longer book. It was a lot more comprehensive in a lot of ways, but I think publishers tend to feel that the general book audience doesn't want to be weighed down with a lot of detail and stuff. And maybe they're right, I don't know. But my attitude is with this book that this book is very personal to me because it was such a journey for me that I do not want to let it be butchered
by
anyone else but myself.
Yeah, I got you, definitely. So, I mean, this topic of you know, generally symbolism and going into movie symbolism, I guess it's a topic close to your heart. I mean, just looking at your blog, secretsun.blogspot.com, you know, you can see a lot of that material up there. I mean, how do you want to go into this? I mean, do you want to talk about a specific movie, Solaris?
Let me tell you about how I really started to notice this symbolism. I think that's a good place to start. I was trained as an artist, a cartoonist, but I also worked as a storyboard artist for commercials and films and things like that. And I'm very much trained to look at a movie as a collection of what they're called key frames. And when a storyboard is put together for a film, they will concentrate on the key frames of you know, particular action.
Right.
And these are the frames that you want to be iconic. These are the shots that, you know, you want to exist like paintings. In one class, we analyzed Days of Heaven, the Terrence Malick film.
Right.
Seen that? It's a beautiful film.
Yeah.
And when you look at it frame by frame, it's almost like a bunch of great master paintings sort of strung together as a film. It's an amazing piece of art. And that sort of trained me to realize that when films are being made, they're being made as collections of images. And the motion and the movement and things like that are almost secondary. They're almost constructed as comic books. For instance, the Matrix film, the first Matrix film, was constructed as a comic book. And this is very much in my alley, and I did this professionally in New York with advertising, which is a whole other discussion when you talk about symbolism. But it really sensitized me to how films use imagery, use symbolism, and do it in a way that it really speaks to the subconscious mind much more than the conscious mind. I don't want to necessarily say subliminally, but it is something that speaks to the subconscious mind, which is why I generally concentrate on using still shots on my blog rather than actual clips.
Right. Yeah, I see what you mean. It's a better way to focus on an image and concentrate and really get the... It doesn't just rush by, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, you know, you need to really absorb what the filmmaker is saying, because when they set these shots up, they are almost working like painters, you know? It's just that it's a motion picture.
Right.
But they conceive these images and these scenes very much the same way a painter would. They compose them the same way. So, you know, that's something that I really understand. And I saw how it was done, you know, in person. And the other thing I wanted to tell people that I haven't really talked about a lot is that I had actually worked on a couple movie scripts back in the late 90s. I did a graphic novel called Halo and Angel Story that pretty much immediately got interest from people in the movie business.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent about 3 years working on the script, reworking on the script, meeting with people, talking to lawyers, things like that. I mean, it was a pretty arduous process. And I also did another script with a friend of mine in the early 2000s, which was sort of a an updating of Snow White, which was, let me just say that we submitted that film to Disney, and then shortly afterwards we heard that they were planning their own live-action updating of Snow White, which I thought was kind of amusing.
Mm.
That hasn't been produced yet, but we did this screenplay that was very much a commentary on how things like Alias and La Femme Nikita are really fairy tales themselves, and we just incorporated elements from Snow White. And that, you know, we dealt with a lot of people at Sony and Disney and studios like that. I mean, most movies, nothing ever comes of. I mean, most movies aren't even optioned.
Right.
But it was a really interesting process because I really got a chance to meet with people and sort of get a backstage look at how things are created. I've been to the Disney lot a couple times, actually, as well.
Mm, very interesting. So, I mean, how do you approach a film? I mean, either if we talk about Solaris or Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, how do you kind of approach it? And do you, like, sit down and really, you know, break it down as you said and pause every frame like that? Or do you watch it many times? How do you do it?
Well, first of all, I usually, the films that I analyze are usually films that I really love and
right.
really addicted to, and I don't understand why I'm addicted to them, you know, until I realize that they're just very, very dense with all the symbolic information, and that's something that I really respond to.
Mm.
Basically, what I've done is that I just basically watch and watch and watch and rewatch and rewatch these films over and over again until things make themselves known to me. I mean, it's fascinating that most this information just speaks to the subconscious. Most people don't make it conscious because it's not designed to be made conscious. It's designed to speak to the conscious mind, the subconscious mind. So it really, it's a question of repeating the process until the images start to reveal themselves. And that's really what happens, is that the images reveal themselves after a while. I studied mythology, as we discussed on your last program. I've studied mythology and all these things since I was very, very young, you know, raised on comic books, which, as I write, are new mythology. So, you know, I'm sort of well-versed in this this genre. And also, I'm just very specialized in the sort of the mystery school symbolism that seems to be the predominant form of symbolism that we'll see in a lot of these films. It's all based on the mystery school tradition, and you know, its outgrowths over the years. You know, the Knights Templar, Freemasonry, Rosicrucianism, Theosophy, some of the Gnostic text sects, which were more pagan oriented, for lack of a better word.
Mm-hmm.
It's just something, because it's sort of the richest vein to tap into, and I just see this material expressing itself in our films, whether or not it's consciously. I mean, I cannot definitively say whether it's a conscious process because I don't know these people personally.
Right, right.
You know, it could very well be that these symbols are so powerful and have been around for so long that they're expressing themselves. I don't know. I mean, I have my suspicions, but...
Right, right, right.
You know, you have to be very careful because I don't know these people. I don't know what they're trying to say. But, you know, when you realize that symbolic... you know, symbolism is a language, and is a sequence that you can predict. It's very funny how the sequences will replay themselves over and over again in a predictive fashion.
I mean, let's take a few examples here. I don't know if you want to begin to talk a little bit about the X-Files, perhaps.
That's where I started, exactly.
Right, right. So tell us a little bit about that and how you discovered some of the symbolism in there, for instance.
Well, the X-Files is, you know, to me, it's just such an amazing thing. It was on for so long. I mean, you'll have a film like 2001, which is basically a two-hour film, and then you have the X-Files, which is essentially a 200-hour film.
Right, right.
You have all these different episodes. There's so much to tap into, and they're quite upfront that they what they are doing is writing mythology. I mean, that's what they call it. They put out the DVD box that's called the Mythology set.
Right.
And back when the X-Files was very popular, this was back more in the early days of the web and the days of the Usenet, when you had a lot of people doing conspiracy research, that kind of thing, in the wake of Behold the Pale Horse and whatnot.
Right.
You know, people were noticing, very influenced by what William Cooper was saying with films like The Lion King. And there were actually some people who pointed out the obvious fact that the Mulder abduction storyline in the last two seasons of The X-Files was basically based in particularly Plutarch's drama of Isis and Osiris.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a researcher named David Flynn who put this on his site and actually registered a domain name called Heaven Mulder's Baby. And never went anywhere with it. He never followed up on it. And I suspect it's because he wasn't familiar enough with the mythology to really pick out the details.
Uh-huh.
So I took it upon myself. It was sort of like a punk rock do-it-yourself thing, because I was waiting around for so long for him to update his page that I just did it myself. And it was just an amazing process, because the symbolism is so prevalent. It's just unbelievably detailed. It's unbelievably well disguised, and it's just impossible. I mean, I can say with absolute assurance that there's no way that symbolism is accidental. but I did that site, I did that page, and I called it Nebit Het Gish, an X-Files exegesis.
Right.
And it got a lot of great response from people in the X-Files community, and still does to this day.
Mm-hmm.
And that really sort of started me on the road, because the movie symbolism book that we were discussing actually started out as a book on Gnostic themes in film. And I was trying to express it in a different way than a lot of the other books.
Mm.
And saying that film is sort of where we can create our gnosis, because it occurred to me at some point in time that gnosis is really just another form of faith. You know, if it's not based in a sort of concrete experience, you're ascribing faith to this gnosis. And what I saw that science fiction and fantasy film was doing was, making this gnosis, the spiritual phenomenon, material. It was concretizing it, and making it manifest. But I couldn't really go too far with that, because it just isn't enough of that in these films. And it wasn't until I really stumbled upon the Isis Osiris Mystery School symbolism that everything just opened up like a flower. It was amazing.
Hmm. So you would say that the theme throughout the last two seasons of the X-Files is a retelling of the Isis Osiris story.
Yeah, in amazing detail. And the thing that fascinates me is that they used this in the context of UFOs and aliens, and it's my personal belief that that's sort of taking it back to first principles, that this is not something that I can actually prove, because none of us can, but it seems to me that when the Egyptians talk about God's coming from the stars and teaching them how to build civilization, and we see this in a number of different cultures.
Right.
That you can have certain mystical interpretations of that, but you can also have the obvious interpretation that beings came from the stars and actually did these things. So it was fascinating that the X-Files did that in that context. I can refer people to the page on my blog, because it's really something that you need to see. It's unbelievably dense in detail. But for instance, John Doggett is obviously Anubis,
right?
The dog-headed god.
And isn't there even some scenes in there where they refer to him as reliable as a dog and things like that?
Yeah, things the dogged. Yeah. The fascinating thing to me also is how Chris Carter used the '70s TV show Isis to give little clues that Scully had, in fact, become Isis. And this was actually in the beginning of the seventh season, an episode called The Sixth Extinction. And there are just so many interesting visual clues where he ties back to the Isis TV show. I mean, it's well known that The X-Files was constantly, you know, referencing old films and old TV shows,
right?
You know, particularly in the casting. But the dead giveaway with Scully and Isis is a character named Dr. Barnes in The Sixth Extinction, who is also a character in the Isis TV show. So that's something that people can see on the blog too. It's very, very funny and very obvious.
Right.
But that's something that, you know, they were very upfront about in other contexts, that, you know, they were constantly referring to their favorite movies and shows and things like that in that show.
So do you want to talk a little bit about the episode Medusa, or do you want to move on? What I mean, that's
sure.
Very rich. Yeah,
Medusa was a very interesting episode because what had happened is that David Duchovny was contracted for a limited amount of appearances in the first half of the eighth season of The X-Files. And then he returned for, I think, 11 episodes in total. And before... And that started with an episode called Per Manum, which went into the conception of William, who was a very obvious Horus stand-in. And I'd like to add also that the new X-Files film that's coming out in July is going to, you know, the storyline is, you know, concerning, is, you know, William is going to have some sort of significance in that story, which I think is really interesting. They claim that it's not a mythology story, which is, I don't believe. But anyhow, they did an episode called Medusa, and it was very much a Masonic initiation analogy, where Doggett was sent down to the Boston subway system to find this contagion that was causing, you know, these horrible burns, almost like acid on people. And it was this green contagion that was seeping in through cracks in the subway tunnel ceiling, water from Boston Harbor. Now, the interesting thing about this, and again, this is people need to see how these sequences are laid out, but... the green contagion is to me, an obvious analogy to the Green Dragon Tavern, which was the first Masonic lodge in the United States,
right.
In Boston. And they were the people who planned the Boston Tea Party. And they also, you know, were very involved in the planning of the revolution itself. The sort of the giveaway on that regard is that the first... scene in that episode, Medusa, deals with an officer, Phil Brick, who's at Clay Street Station. Brick, Clay, you know, it's kind of a funny little joke, which they did all the time, again.
Right, right.
And people have written books on all the in-jokes in X-Files episodes. So, you know, and there's also, again, we see this character who's a stand-in for Horus, this young boy who's mute, and whose presence never is explained, and leads Doggett and this other character through this room underneath the subway, which is, the walls are all green, they're all coated with this green contagion. And to me, I interpret that as the Green Dragon Tavern. And, you know, Medusa has sort of a tie-in. We see some films where Medusa is depicted as a dragon-like figure.
Right, right.
Clash of the Titans, I think, is probably the best example of that. And then there's also this image we're seeing here is Doggett's resurrection when his skin becomes green, and that's paralleled with the esoteric Freemasonry, where the Hiram Biff character is actually Osiris. His skin becomes green after he's knocked down by a blow to the head, which is also part of the Master Mason ceremony in Freemasonry, where the last of the ruffians knocks Hiram Abiff dead with a blow to the head.
And right, right.
That's, you know, like I said, I mean, it's something that people need to see how it's sequentially ordered.
Right.
And that's something that I really focus on in The Secret Sun is sequence, because symbolism can kind of come and go, but when it's ordered in sequence, you know, I pay much greater attention to it.
Mm.
You know, because it, when it's ordered in a sequence that matches, for instance, the mystery tradition, it's that much harder to justify as being random or accidental.
Right, right. So, I mean, there are so many things there that we potentially could pick up on. What do you think? Do you want to move on, talk a little bit about Solaris, perhaps, another awesome movie?
Yeah, it's an interesting transition, because The X-Files is very much, at its basis, it's a love story, and it's a love story that the whole symbolism of Isis and Osiris, you know, in my interpretation, was added into.
Mm.
And I'd also like to mention that you know, the co-executive producer of The X-Files featured that essay that I had done on The X-Files on his blog, which I took to be very much an endorsement, even
yeah,
though it might not have been intended to be so.
Hmm.
And that's something, you know, this love story, and it's something that you see in the mysteries, that they're all based on these dramas. For instance, the Persephone and Demeter.
Right.
And her descent into hell and this mother's love for her daughter, which was also, I might add, I haven't done this on the blog yet, but that was also featured in an X-Files episode. They did Persephone and Demeter.
Mm.
And Isis and Osiris, Cabal and Attis, you know, you have these stories that are dramas, and they become very emotionally invested in the inherence in the ancient world, in the ancient mysteries.
Right.
And that's something that, you know, I mean, that's the basis of great drama. So on a, you know, just on a surface level, a lot of these guys go to college, they study literature, they study history, and they might come across these stories and decide that these are great, you know, this is good grist for the mill. I mean, these stories have been around for thousands of years. You know, maybe they'll still work in the movies.
Well, exactly. That's an interesting point, because do you think that these stories, again, are so kind of hardwired almost into the human psyche that in order to, you know, to have a successful story, they know that very good trick, so to speak, here is actually pick up something that is an ancient story that has been told and retold throughout human history. And when they consequently do that, it becomes a huge success, because it on some level it kind of, you know, resonates with people. What do you think?
No, I absolutely think so, because these stories, I mean, a mother searching for her lost daughter, I mean, that's very, very compelling, particularly if you're a parent.
Of course.
You know, a wife whose husband is taken from her, and she resurrects him through his son. I mean, these are very compelling stories that not only tie into these natural cycles. For instance, Persephone and Demeter is, you know, commonly acknowledged to be a story of winter, and, you know, in explaining the winter.
And right.
Isis and Osiris, I mean, that's the inundation of the Nile and things like that.
Hmm.
So these stories not only have this meaning, this greater meaning in the natural rhythms of life, but also in, you know, the lesser rhythms of people's interactions with one another.
Hmm.
And then there's also what I'm trying to discover, you know, in my writing, is what greater esoteric meaning does it have to these people? What symbolism is attached to these films? And also, you know, when you look at creation myths and things like that, and just all these gods who come from the stars and teach people the arts of civilization, or actually create people out of, you know, the dust or the clay,
right,
or, you know, of lesser beings or whatever. I mean, where do these stories come from? I mean, do they just pop up out of the ground? To me, it seems to make more sense that the gods would come from underneath the earth, you know, where all life comes from, and you know, or from the oceans or something. You know what
right,
I mean?
Right.
Why from the stars? It doesn't make any sense.
Hmm.
So,
unless
love stories, what I call solar love stories, that all seem to be tie into solar dying, resurrecting gods. For instance, Solaris. You know, a very obvious example, and that's the remake, by the way. I not necessarily the original. But the remake done by James Cameron and Steven Soderbergh has, you know, just incredibly blatant symbolism in it. Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, less so than Solaris, but there's very interesting ties to Freemasonry in that film, in that the title of the film itself is taken from a poem by Alexander Pope, who was a Freemason, and
right.
written in 1717, which is when the Grand Lodge of England, the first, you know, generally recognized official Masonic body, was formed.
Mm.
And 40-Year-Old Virgin, which is the whole other story all itself. But I sort of I grouped these films together because they had very similar motifs in the symbolism. There was castration symbolism. There was dying and resurrecting. And there was also the sun, the sunshine, and
right.
things like that. For instance, 40-Year-Old Virgin ends, the film ends with the cast, the entire cast of the film, singing Let the Sunshine In from the musical Hair. It has nothing to do with the story at all. It's just completely out of nowhere.
Hmm.
And, you know, it's just, those are the three films that I've been focusing on, but there are actually others as well. I've started to focus on the film Pushing Tin with John Cusack, Billy Bob Thornton, and Angelina Jolie, which is very obviously, to me, sort of a combination of The Death of Osiris and then the contendings of Horus and Set, with John Cusack playing the role of Horus, Billy Bob Thornton playing the role of Set, Cate Blanchett playing the role of Hathor, and Angelina Jolie playing the role of Nephthys. And that's something that I'm going to be that I've actually wrote about in the original manuscript of my book.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the symbolism is so subtle and so, but so pervasive that it becomes hard to argue with the fact that, maybe they can.
Right, right.
Maybe it's completely unconscious on their part, but it's all there and it all matches the sequence.
Well, I mean, if these are stories that comes out from the unconscious, you know, retelling of a mythology, then okay, granted, on some level, this actually might be unconscious, but this is the way the story turns out because the story wants to be told, if you know what I'm saying.
Well, sometimes the stories want to tell themselves. It's the question for the ages. Where do these stories come from? Why do these symbols appear? Why do they appear in sequence? Why do they appear in a way that it becomes very difficult to say that that's not what the film is about. Whether or not it's intentional is another argument, but it's there. And, to tell you the truth, the least fascinating explanation to me is that it's intentionally put in there. I'm always kind of disappointed to think that that's maybe how it's working.
I mean, really?
To me, it's much more exciting to think that these archetypes are so powerful and so eternal that they express themselves in these stories and use filmmakers and writers and producers and all these people as sort of unwitting pawns.
Right, right. And
it's also very far-fetched, but, you know, I'd love to believe that.
Would you back that up, that claim, so to speak, with the fact that a lot of interviews you see with some of the directors, people behind the movie, it seems to be like the story actually goes right over the head, and it seems like they don't actually know what they have been a part of. You know what I'm saying?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's something that I wrote about on the blog, is that a lot of times, I'll give a great example. I was listening to the commentary track on Dark City, which is a movie that I absolutely adore. And they were all really unsure what the movie was about. They didn't know what it was supposed to mean. And I thought that was really puzzling because I know when you're making a movie, I mean, absolutely every detail is charted out by hundreds of people.
Right.
You have hundreds of people running around with clipboards looking at the placement of flowers and of rocks and how far open a window is in a particular scene.
Right, right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Have these people making sure that absolutely everything is done according to a plan. And when they don't understand what the film is about, I mean, you know, granted, I've written stories that I didn't understand until much later what I was writing about.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to me a movie like that, that seems such a powerful, almost religious allegory, they should have some idea what they're trying to say in that film. I would just assume so.
Right, right.
But to me, again, I see that as the dying, rising solar savior. And, you know, you see that at the end of the film, where the climax of the film is the sun coming out.
Right.
And the oceans appear.
Yeah.
And these characters, the strangers who control the city, I mean, they're adverse to both water and light.
Hmm.
And this character, John Murdoch, who you very cleverly pointed out has a link to Marduk, you know, his powers are never explained. We never understand why he can do this. We never understand why he can control the sun and the oceans and the elements and things like that.
Mm.
It's just completely out of nowhere.
Mm.
And it only makes sense if you do look at it in as an allegory for a much older, you know, spiritual, religious, mythological tradition.
Right, right.
Then it makes perfect sense.
Absolutely. Hey, I want to return a little bit to the Solaris again and talk about a few things in there. One, of course, is an image that you had on your blog with the creation of man, basically God reaching down, and the equivalent to that, the scene in Solaris, but. That seems to be in reverse, because the kid is the one standing up and reaching down. Tell us a little bit about your interpretation of that one.
Well, if you look at the mystery tradition, the personification of the mysteries was Hippocrates, which means Horus the child. And he was a silent character. He was often depicted with his finger to his lips. And the Egyptians saw that as a symbol of childhood, but the Greeks saw that as the symbol of silence. And the term mystery itself comes from a Greek word meaning to close the mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you look at these films in context and in sequence and match them up to these dramas that the mystery schools celebrated and practiced in their rituals, it makes perfect sense that Solaris, the sun, is recreating this man in its own image, and Horus the child in the mystery tradition becomes Horus the elder, the son, the man, in that trinity. So it makes perfect sense in that light that, you know, this whole story that this character is undergoing is actually some sort of initiation.
Right.
And that he's being reborn into the mysteries. And if you read about the mystery schools themselves, I mean, it's really remarkable. Their practices were extreme. They would subject their adherents to sensory deprivation, sensory overload, all sorts of forms of abuse or exposure. I mean, it was just, they were put through ordeals before they were allowed to, join in these cults. And we see sort of a remnant of that with hazing in the fraternities. But that, you know, that the hazing in the fraternities is very silly. But you had the same process in the mystery religions, but it was very extreme. And what it was meant to do was it was meant to actually transform the individual from a person who just exists in the society and follows the rules into a person who's part of this cult, who have this different way of looking at the world. And you
see mm-hmm.
things where people who were in these mystery traditions were seen as, you know, the living, and people outside them were seen as the dead.
Right.
But in order to join these groups, you had to be put through some arduous experiences, and it didn't matter who you were. I mean, the Roman Emperor Hadrian, for example, underwent these initiations themselves, and he was terrified. I mean, this was a guy who was a warrior and a statesman, and he was terrified by these experiences. So if you look at that in that context, in that last scene when the Prometheus, again from mythology, is being absorbed into Solaris, that scene, that sequence where the gift of life is given to Chris Kelvin by this silent character makes perfect sense.
Hmm.
And actually only makes sense in that regard. So many of these things don't make sense in a narrative fashion.
For instance,
the X-Files, a lot of X-Files fans said, you know, these stories don't make any sense. Well, they make perfect sense if you look at them in the context of the mythology.
Right, exactly. How about the idea of time and of course even the idea of not dying in Solaris? This is kind of repeated in the sense that the people can't die because they have been resurrected, so to speak, already, and they're eternal now. They can live forever. But also the idea of time, that time is something that ceased to exist. And that is also, from what I've heard, a kind of a mythology or something that is recurring within Freemasonry. What do you know about that?
Well, I think that comes from Mithraism. You know, we have Aeon, who's the lion-headed god of time. And, you know, I've read some sort of interpretations that the devil in, you know, the Mithraic traditions was time itself, because time kills everybody. You know, time takes everything away from you.
Right.
And one thing I've noticed that there were a couple different interpretations of is this motif of reversal of time. For instance, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind is told in reverse. Memento, another film that I'm going to be looking at very closely in the future,
right,
is told in reverse. That sequence that we talked about in Solaris is told in reverse. And right now, I just want to let people know that this symbol here, where he's taking off his space helmet, this ties into John the Baptist. In a lot of these films, we see very explicit John the Baptist symbolism, where it involved the removal of the space helmet, which is a symbolic gesture.
Right.
The way, in the same way the Eucharist is the symbolic body of Christ, but it's a symbolic gesture of the beheading. And some of these films actually have, you know, literal beheadings.
Like in Dune and not 2001, but it's a similar scene there with the space helmet off.
Yeah, and the way that shot. excuse me. Stanley Kubrick was very clear that that film was a religious film. I mean, I have a ton of quotes that I dug up where he's speaking very explicitly that 2001: A Space Odyssey was a religious film.
Hmm.
And actually, Arthur C. Clarke, who passed away recently, referred to it as the first $10 million religious movie. you know, and again, that's death and rebirth. It's the same symbolism again. We have a lot of solar symbolism. I mean, one thing that I want people to notice when they watch 2001 is that every time you see the monolith, it's somehow linked with the sun. It's identified with the sun.
Right.
It's either superimposed over the sun, or the sun is reflecting upon it, or it comes with the sunrise. Every time you see the monolith, it's the sun. Now, personally, I'm not quite sure if the esoteric interpretation of the sun matches what you or I would think of it, you know?
Hmm.
I think there's a lot of this solar symbolism that seems to be manifesting itself in the movies and in advertising and also in Christian churches, which I think is really kind of remarkable.
Right.
I'm not quite sure what that means. I'm a little leery of it. It seems a little disturbing to me. I'm not quite sure what this, especially a rising sun, you know, I'm not quite sure exactly what these symbols are trying to say, but they if you look for them, they're really starting to come everywhere.
You know what, Chris?
Here we are right now on screen. I mean, I did a collection. I mean, literally spent an hour just Googling different churches, and you see the sun
right
everywhere. And I found a number of churches that use the sun in place of a cross or a Bible or a dove or any of these kind of traditional Christian symbols.
Of course.
And I was really struck by that because I had a pretty conservative, conventional Christian upbringing. And, you know, I mean, I know what these symbols mean, and I know what symbols the church, you know, sort of inculcated into me when I was a kid.
Right.
Here we are again. I mean, I literally found over 100 of these things within an hour.
It is, it is. Yes, Jordan Maxwell would say it's the Son of God, the S-O-N of God. That's what this is about, you know.
Yeah, but there's something going on, though. There seems to be something different. I mean, it's, you know, I'm really not sure, because any first-year divinity student is going to learn the history of early Christianity and realize that, you know, its opposition was the solar cults in Rome.
Right.
You know, so incorporating these imagery into Christian worship, to me, is it's unusual, to say the least. It's kind of alarming in some ways.
Right, right.
So, you know, but
you know what, Chris? We should actually begin to round things up here for our first segment and continue our discussion in a little while here in the members section, but. We have a few things that we want to go through here before we finish off, and one thing is that I would like you to pop out the question again, because as we have had no one calling in yet, we need to we still want to hand out two of those books, so the contest is still going, so to speak. So the email option is open still, redicecreation@gmail.com. Give us a mail, but give us the question again, Chris.
All right. Before Thor had his own comic in the 1960s, Jack Kirby created Thor as a villain. Which superhero did this version of Thor from the 1940s fight?
Okay, there we go. Have a ponder on that one, and if you think you have the right answer, send us an email, redicecreations@gmail.com. Okay, so let's do like this, Chris. Tell us a little bit more about your book and, of course, your website or your blog before we round things up here.
Yeah, they're connected in a way. I've got this book. Again, it's a 180,000 word manuscript that I feel very passionate and personal about, and is broken up into two halves. The first half traces back the what I call the ancient dramas, the death of Osiris, things like that, death of John the Baptist, and the commonalities between them, the links between them, and these groups that seem to arise over these symbols, over these dramas. And the second half of the book goes into how these themes, these symbols, these mythologies manifest themselves in these huge, big-budget popcorn movies. You know, we obviously know about Star Wars. To me, Star Wars is almost the least interesting one of these films, because it's so obvious. The symbolism is very much up on the surface. I'm
right.
More interested in some of these films where the symbolism is a little bit harder to pick out. I start with Star Trek and end with, I believe I ended with the Chronicles of Narnia. And all the solar symbolism in that film.
Mm.
And, you know, I will be updating it there. I've been really fascinated by the symbolism of Kybele and Attis that has manifested itself in these films, and want to sort of, you know, incorporate that, because a lot of people not realize this, but the Mithraic mysteries were for men only. And the wives of the Mithraists would often be drawn into the cult of Kybele, who is very much sort of a counterpart to Hera and Juno and Rhea, you know, these great mother gods.
Right.
And that's what I thought was very interesting in these strands, where Mithraism had such a powerful influence on the Knights Templar and Freemasonry.
Right.
That, you know, you almost have to look for the Kybele symbolism.
And, you know, some of these things also, of course, are you know, as you're researching more in your coming movie symbolism book, I guess this is something that you're kind of doing online, so to speak, on your blog. Isn't that right? Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, what I'm doing is that there's a lot of questions that I still need to work on. There's a lot of themes that I still need to explore, and I'm doing that in real time on the blog. And I'm really loving the blog, because I can just take certain themes or symbols that have struck my fancy at the time and just do it in real time, and I get feedback from people, and you know, I can go live and I'm not edited and I'm not censored and things like that.
Right, right.
And I can use, you know, a lot more imagery. I can use a lot more, you know, clips from YouTube and stuff like that. So it's a lot of fun.
Mm.
I'm really getting very heavily into this stuff online, you know, every day. Every day I'm putting stuff up and, you know, I really want people to check it out and see where I'm going, because I'm really heading towards a very coherent narrative that will express itself in the book, and, you know, people can become part of that.
Right, right. Okay, so Chris, let's take a little break right here. We're going to continue talking, maybe dive into a little bit more about some of the Oscar or Academy Awards, also the a little bit more on Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind and 40-Year-Old Virgin. We have a few more things to touch upon here. So stay with us, Chris, and we'll continue our discussion in the member section.
Excellent, thanks.
Okay, so members, log in to the member section at redicecreations.com, or just click the button above here somewhere where it now is, and on that page you'll see the password to enter into continue watching this live broadcast. We're going to take a 5 or 10 minute break, something like that, so go and take a coffee or a cigarette, whatever, some use, or why not a big glass of non-fluoridated water or something like that. And we'll continue our discussion with Chris Knowles. Many thanks to producer Fredrik Palmgren for a great job here during this first segment. Also want to say thanks to my friend Petter and Amrit for helping out with some great, you know, some gear and getting some of this stuff together here for our live show. So thank you for tuning in, and heads up for our next live show. But members, we'll see you in about 5 to 10 minutes. This is Henrik Palmgren. Talk soon.